I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Changing Times, the Alan Wood Conversations.
Proudly supported by Kildare County Council.
I mean, I have a soft spot for that song because I've said many times, not only did I get the bank manager off my back, I got my poor mother off her knees. So I have a big debt to that song.
I've been reflecting, Mary, on some of the guests that we've had in recent weeks and the conversations we've had since starting the podcast. And honestly, the art of storytelling is definitely alive and well in this country, isn't it?
It's really wonderful. And you know, it's not just the story that they're telling, because what we're getting is a timeless piece of their history, their story, their soul. And, you know, I don't think either of us takes it for granted when people sit here and chat to us about their lives and the changes that have been part of their lives.
I agree completely. I mean, there's a great generosity in just sharing. It's quite incredible that people are so willing to sit and chat. And so I hope our listeners who are willing to sit and listen are enjoying the journeys as much as we have been enjoying them. That word timeless you just used, actually, it's a pretty good description of our guest this week. We're sitting looking at him. I mean, this man has near enough 8 decades done on this world, and maybe a wee bit more. Take 30 years off that and nobody's going to argue with you. He's amazing. We have a great treat for our listeners, don't we?
Yes, and we are really honoured and thrilled to host this extraordinary artist who, I suppose he's in a way crafted the soundtrack to our lives, hasn't he? A towering figure in the music industry.
For sure. He's a man whose melodies, whose songs have graced everything from quiet Irish nights to the grand stages of Eurovision. He's charmed audiences worldwide with a gift that really appeals to an awful lot of audiences. Hits that have climbed the charts, songs that have won hearts, music that can capture the spirit, not just of a city, but of a people, of a whole nation, emotion, history.
Iconic titles like The Town I Loved So Well, The Old Man, Puppet on a String, Congratulations, Ireland's Call, there's so many.
If we were to list the accolades that this man earned, we'll be here all day. Platinum records, prestigious awards, 5 Ivor Novello awards, Grammy nominations, you name it. He certainly has earned the accolade of national treasure. And Phil, you're so welcome to Alan Wood. Needless to remark, I'm talking about Phil Coulter, who's joined us. Well, I grew up with Phil's music, but more importantly, on a day many, many years ago when I was working in another world back in Queen's University in Belfast, I had the great privilege of giving the citation when Phil got an honorary doctorate in music from that university. And I was reflecting back. There's an old expression that says that universities can, they polish stones, but they dim diamonds. And I just wonder about your experience of university at that time. It'd be very different today. Music in Queen's, not exactly easy going. It wasn't a place that was ever going to affirm you and where you were going then, was it?
If you backtrack a little bit to what you know, the run up to getting to Queen's, getting a scholarship to Queen's, which is important in terms of the kind of mindset. St. Columb's College, as universally accepted, was a place that produced achievers, you know, the likes of John Hume, Seamus Heaney, Brian Friel, Seamus Dean, Paul Brady, whatever. So when you got to the university, you thought you'd really kind of achieve something. You weren't at the first level. In our house, my eldest brother, Joe, had been to Maynooth. And he was a bit of a brain box. It wasn't that I was the first to kind of get into that third level thing. But nonetheless, and bear in mind, like, Belfast was a big metropolis. This was this is in early 50s, or 1953. It was a big deal. Belfast was the big smoke. So to get there was a great sense of having arrived, you know, in the real world, the big time.
And were your parents very ambitious for you to get there?
Absolutely.
Were
absolutely.
They? What was their background?
Well, I mean, the thing in Derry, as Catholics, we were all taught that we were the hewers of wood and the drawers of water, you know? So anything you could do to raise yourself above that, it was by dint of your smarts, your talent, and your hard work. It keeps coming back to that, you know? For them, it was a kind of a justification of the hours that we had spent, like at the Lexus and Con, or with me, they were spending music on piano lessons and stuff.
They wouldn't have had big money, your mum and dad.
Not at all. My dad was a cop, you know. Mm-hmm. He was a detective in the RUC.
But that was unusual in itself.
That's another story. That's another day. That's another podcast. Yeah. Well, that's certainly. But so getting to Queen's was certainly a big thing. You know, all those Derry boys were all kind of intimidated, really. So the Derry boys just all kind of hang about together in the Catholic chaplaincy.
And Phil, where did the music come from? Everybody associates Derry with music, don't
sure.
they?
Yeah.
What is it about that?
Well, I don't know. Everybody in Derry, well, thinks they can sing, whether they can or not, that's for sure. And they think they have a divine right to stand up.
In that memorable phrase, in the Derry air. Yeah. There's music there in the Derry air.
Well, there is, isn't there?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And that was a language, wasn't it?
For sure. Yeah. For sure. I mean, there'd been a tradition of music in Derry for years. Choral music, the Dockers had a choir, for example, that used to compete in the choral music. So there's that kind of thing going on. Then in the 40s, there was a lot of, there was the RAF, there was the US personnel and the British Army, all stationed in and around Derry. And on weekends, they would be running dances, you know, or socials. So there was always a need for a band to go and play to entertain the troops. Mm-hmm. And I did that on a number of occasions. Mm-hmm. It was one of the few jobs in Derry, if you turned up for an interview, they didn't ask you what school you went to. You know, they asked you, what did you play?
Mm,
and
wow.
So guys who maybe learned the trumpet to play in St. Eugene's Brass and Reed Band, for example, now had a chance of playing in the Magnificent Seven and earning a few quid. There was a time in Derry where you couldn't have thrown a stone without hitting somebody that played in the show. But before stone throwing became a popular art form.
For other reasons.
Yes. Yeah. So that was very much part of the Derry thing in Derry. Yeah. And music, more than just something that you studied in school or something you sang on Sunday in church or at the annual fete. It was something that you, even in my own house growing up, that notion of when there was a big night in our area, as they call it in Derry, it would happen in Coulter's because we had a piano.
Was there sympathy with that kind of music when you went to Queen's? Did you, in the music department in Queen's, had they a clue what was going on in Derry?
Absolute zip. Absolutely zip. No. No. None at all. None at all. That was a purely academic thing, you know.
Mm. It must have been awful disappointing, though. Yeah, realizing, yeah. You know, they don't get it.
I mean, you know, it was difficult for me to, through the day, or through the night times, to get worked up about Little Richard and Fats Domino and the Everly Brothers, and then the following day to go and get equally intense about 16th century counterpoint, you know.
Right.
That was tough. The basics of, like, you know, learning about harmony, orchestration, voicings, all that kind of stuff, that did certainly, that's something which I may not have got the B mush, but I had a lot of that, you know, a lot of that just imbibing that kind of information. Mm-hmm. So I would say that I learned more from a practical point of view as a kind of an arranger or a musician in my first session, my first recording session with like 20 or 30 musicians, facing them playing one of my arrangements than I did in 5 years at Queen's.
Mm. My Lord. Really?
Did you always feel, Phil, that you would make a career out of music, that you would earn your living with music?
Well, that came later.
Did it?
That came later, yeah. I think probably by the end of my time at Queen's, I'd figured, I don't think I want to be a music teacher.
What kind of conversation would you have with your mommy and daddy about that? You know, they'd have wanted the settled career for you.
Very little conversation.
Yeah, really?
Very little. There was one very dark, very, very dark period when I think in my third year, when I had screwed up from the exams, I thought, well, I'll get through it, just knuckle down next year and maybe pull through. But the education board in Derry withdrew my scholarship.
Oh, Lord.
So I come back from work in the summer as a piano player over in Butlins, I think, in Kent, to be told that I didn't have a scholarship. When I arrived home, I was presented with a letter.
Well, your parents must have been just savagely disappointed.
Jesus Christ. My mother was in tears.
Oh, dear. Mm.
Because I'd let them down, you know. And my father just harumped and kind of glared a bit and said, "This, I knew this was going to end in tears," kind of stuff. You know? Swear to Christ. But here's the thing. I had, in that summer job, earned enough money that I was kind of going to keep for like futures. But that paid for my next year, Queen's.
Yeah.
So I was funding myself for the next year. Mm-hmm. But even at that, it still didn't get to the final. I think it was a huge disappointment. For them, even bigger disappointment when I didn't finish the degree. They didn't quite get why I was going off to London and what my mother called that jazz music. You know, my father did set me down and tell me, mark my words, boy, this will all end in tears.
He did.
Oh, for sure. I remember it very well.
This was a break.
This was like, not only have you screwed up in the university, but now you're heading off to London with some mad notions about pop music. I mean, that's like, ooh, that's compounding the felony, you know? And my mother was bombarding heaven. She was lighting candles. She was saying novenas.
Look how they work now.
Yeah. Well, but she was just praying that I wouldn't end up living in the streets in London, you know? So that's true. That's true. So for the first kind of couple of years when it was tough, just to try and get a foothold in the music business and try and just stay above water, try and get ahead, and try and avoid the cheeky letters coming from the bank manager, you know, on a kind of weekly basis. So finally, after 2 years of knockbacks and perseverance and just knuckling down and realizing you've got a lot to learn here, boy, you've got a lot to learn. You just got to stick with it, stick with the knockbacks and all the kind of this, that, and the other disappointments. You've got to hang in there, which finally that all paid off. When with Puppet on a String in 1967. Oh, yeah. That was a lovely way to arrive, you know, because, I mean, I have a soft spot for that song because I've said many times, not only did I get the bank manager off my back, I got my poor mother off her knees. So I have a big debt to that song. Puppet on a String, followed by Congratulations. And then, you know, then we're on a roll, you know.
And then your parents start to relax then.
Oh, I have to tell you this. After we won the Eurovision, 1967, Puppet on a String. One of the nationalist councillors in Derry, Tommy MacDonald was his name. He was a near neighbour. God love him. He came up with the idea that the corporation, as it was then, the mayor should give me a civic reception in the mayor's parlour.
Proper order.
Whoa, but that's a big deal. Mm. You know, on the day, the mayor's car, this kind of, was a beat up Austin Princess, but it was a big, big beast of a car. I pulled up at our terraced house in Harding Street, and the neighbours are all, I mean, those who were cheering me on were at the front door. The other, merely curious, were just looking from behind behind the curtains. But getting into the mayor's car, and there's the driver with the peak cap on, and just the look on my mother's face, that to me, the one thing that kind of just crystallises, thanks be to Christ, you know, the one thing that crystallises, God, this was something very special, thank you God, was the look on my mother's face.
Mm. Yeah.
That there, Just given all the track record, given all the history and all the screw ups and all the, the conviction that I was going to end up living in the streets, finally to realise there might be some future in this jazz music after all, you know. Yeah, that was a big breakthrough.
You were in London when when the Troubles happened.
Yep.
So you were a little bit removed from all of that, were you?
Well, removed in the sense, geographically removed, but you know, you'd always be aware of it, you know. And you can't come from where I come from and be my age without being aware. Mm-hmm. You know, we're all politically aware in Derry. That's part of our upbringing. So I could see exactly what was going on and followed it, of course.
And then the song.
Well, the genesis of the town I love so well, I happened to be home visiting the folks on the weekend that internment was introduced. And like everybody else in Derry, I just felt that we'd been violated.
Mm.
The reality of having guys who sat beside you in some columns or sat beside you in the Christian Brothers been dragged out of bed at 4 o'clock in the morning, thrown in the back of an army personnel carrier and locked up in Fort George for no good reason. I mean, at that stage, the British intelligence was so poor that they threw the net very wide, you know. If you played GAA, if you played Irish music, if you spoke Irish, whatever, you became suspect, you know, you were a possible terrorist, gunman, whatever. There were guys like... Maybe they went to Cayley Dancers or played Irish music. We're no more terrorists than I was terrorist, but they were dragged out of bed and interned. So that had a big effect on me. I thought this. So I wrote a song, a knee jerk reaction to all that, an anti internment song called "Free the People." And I kind of knew that Luke Kelly would be all over it like a cheap suit, which was as it proved. We recorded with Luke within a couple of weeks, and it was a hit for the Dubliners. But I was aware that there was something in the backstory which was more complicated than just an anti-internment thing, you know. So it's not a great song. It's not a song I'm particularly proud of. But it served a purpose in as much as a songwriter. I'd never been down that area of writing political songs, you know. To me, I was writing pop songs. I was trying to get into the charts. That was my job. So this was a different area. And just seeing that kind of pall of gloom descending on the place, you know. People walking with slumped shoulders. We women going to, with their shopping bags, having to duck under like army patrol. Kids who would draw the nativity scene in the primary school for their teacher. And the teacher would say, "That's lovely there, Elizabeth, but that's the black thing in the air. That's a helicopter, miss." Mm. That's what was going on in Derry. So all of that kind of fed into, I thought, there has to be a song about this. You understand it. You lived through it. And I was so hard. I mean, the melody, I think, was a couple of weeks. Took me almost a couple of years before I was completely happy with polishing the words. Why? Well, a few wrong chosen words in that song.
Yep.
It would have tilted over to become a rebel song. Christ knows the last thing we need, or we needed certainly back then, was another rebel song. There's a great story about when I finished it. I was blessed that at that time I was producing the Dubliners. So fortunate to have a voice like Luke Kelly on hand, you know. I was due to get the Dubliners into the studio. And to kind of rehearse what we were going to do in advance, I went to catch them. They were playing at a working man's club in Sheffield. It was on a wet Monday. I remember it very well. I arrived in this railway hotel. I mean, I don't want to over egg the pudding here, but it was dismal. You know, it was dismal. But you said a railway, and the rain was battering down. And I was in one of those bedrooms with the kind of flock wallpaper, the whole thing going on there. So. After the gig on the Sunday night, I said to Luke, "Right, come down to see me in the morning. I have a song I want to play you. Just you. I don't want the rest of the boys. I just want to play it to you first." So I knew it wouldn't be the morning, being Luke Kelly. So it was kind of about lunchtime. Luke arrived like looking like an unmade bed, you know what I mean? And he's sitting on one of the twin beds. I'm sitting on the other twin bed. And I have my guitar. And I said, "This is the song, Luke." And I reached him the words. I sang the song with my eyes closed. Why? Well, when you're unveiling a song for the first time, especially to a hard nose like Luke Kelly, Luke had an encyclopedic knowledge of folk music. And if I had misstepped, you know, if he thought it was a piece of crap, he would have told me, you know. So I didn't look at him at all. I didn't want to see any reaction. I guess I saw him yawning or going, any of that. Just, I wanted to get the song over. So I finished the song. Can only play in the town I love so deep, 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 deep. Then I opened my eyes and looked across at Luke Kelly. And there were tears in his eyes.
Oh, wow.
That moment.
Oh,
right.
Yes.
I mean, I'm choking up now thinking about it.
Wow. It's quite emotional.
That was the moment I knew that this song had actually hit the market. Mm. That moment, right there.
We started off this conversation talking about the word timeless. That song is utterly timeless. Utterly timeless. Doesn't matter where it's sung, doesn't matter what context it's sung in, wherever it's sung, people's eyes will just, they'll just well up with tears.
I learned a lot.
In my memory.
Yeah. What I wrote that song was, it was particularly about Derry and particularly about that period. But what I learned is the specific can become universal.
Absolutely.
I'm talking about street names in Derry, the Craig and the Moor and the Bog. Yeah. People are singing them now and they don't mean they don't.
Is there a difference between, for you, between, let's take The Town I Loved So Well or Scorn Not His Simplicity or Ireland's Call, each of which has a really specific narrative attached to it. And then you could go to the Bay City Rollers, do you know what I mean? And there's the pop song. What for you is it that allows you to really dig deep into the well of, you know, the human heart and the soul with songs like Scorn Not His Simplicity, The Town I Love So Well, and then to shift gear completely into Congratulations, Puppet on a String, Bay City Rollers?
That's a very good question.
Hi.
First of all, you have to learn the craft. You learn the craft of songwriting. There's no such thing as a born songwriter. You're born with some of the tools, you know. Dermot, whose podcast I heard last week, he would agree with that. I mean, and he's a good, hard-working... Mm-hmm. I mean,
he works hard.
Gets it, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was very impressed with what his story... You have to learn, you know? You'd learn a craft. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, that's the thing which is overlooked today in this era of TikTok songs, which are going to disappear within weeks, you know? Because why? Because there's no structure, there's no substance, there's no, you know, because... The people that are knocking those songs.
It's a five-minute audience.
Yeah, they're not songwriters. These are not songs. Songs are something which endure, you know. Just a few weeks ago, I was at an American, a guy was interviewing me, and he said, can you give me a short definition of a great song? I mean, I know, I don't want to hear about struck music or harmonies, but a short definition of a great song. I said, I'll give you a one-word definition of a great song. Longevity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The song's been around for 50 years. Yeah. It's de facto.
It's a good song. Mm-hmm.
So to get back to your question, mm-hmm. how do you switch gears? First of all, you have to have learned your craft. So I learned my craft in Denmark Street over 3 years. Every second Friday, myself and my then partner, Bill Martin, we would go into the little studio and demo, in other words, make demonstration tapes of six songs, three new songs every week. Words, music, and a little arrangement for the in-house band. That's what I'm talking about, learning the craft, about an apprenticeship. The Monday after that, we would go into our publisher. It was an old-time publisher, Jimmy Phillips. This was a man who knew the game. He was a long-time veteran publisher. He would listen to these newly demoed songs as often as not to throw them in the bin.
Now, did that ever happen to you that he threw stuff?
Jesus,
in
most of them. Yeah, because
this was. But you were learning your craft.
Precisely. That sounds cruel, and it probably is cruel. But that was a necessity of. Used to say.
Did you
to
not
me,
walk out of there sometimes saying, "That's it, I'm out of here"? What's the point?
In the early days, you fall in love with everything you write. That's which is a big mistake. Yeah. You know? He doesn't get it. He would say to me, for example, Mr. Coulter. He was always very polite, always very old school, Mr. Coulter. See that lorry driver, Mr. Coulter. That's the man you want to be thinking about in writing a song. Not your professor at university. That man there. What he was teaching us was don't fall in love with everything you write. If you can say it in three chords rather than 33 chords, that's what writing a pop song is about. You've got 3 minutes to do your business.
Yeah.
Changing Times, the Alan Wood Conversations.
Proudly supported by Kildare County Council.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
But Phil, with the songs there that Mary mentioned, you know, the Town I Loved So yeah. Well and Scorn Not His Simplicity and Ireland's Call, yeah. as well as having learned the craft, you also just bring all of the emotion and the life experience that you've lived into your work, don't you?
Yeah. Well,
and I think that's very special.
Well, I couldn't have done that if I hadn't learned a craft. That's the point of making, you know, translate whatever those feelings
are. Once you have the craft, and then you...
My first exercise down that road was Scorn Not His Simplicity. When my first son was born with Down syndrome. I mean, I was like 22 or something, you know. So you wonder, what's going on? Isn't that supposed to happen? This was our second child.
Your first wee boy.
Our first girl, Siobhan. First wee boy. And because we didn't have any family in London and we couldn't afford babysitters, whatever. So I had to take Siobhan home to Derry and leave her with a mother-in-law while I went back. I got the plane back from Derry, went straight to Dollis Hill Hospital, and into the ward. And I could see that Angela was a bit distracted. I thought maybe she's just tired from the whole thing, you know. Nothing had been said at this stage, and the baby was asleep in a little cot. And the sister came and said, "Mr. Coulter, the paediatrician would like to have a word with you when he's finished his round." Oh, yeah, okay. So this rather pompous little man with a bow tie, and "Mr. Coulter, yes. Well, what age are you?" I said, "I'm 20, 23, 24. And this is your second child?" Yeah, as if, you know, what are you at here? And what's your background? I mean, where you live, where? Cricklewood, yes, you're from Irish. I could hear the mind working. This guy's just come off a building site, you know, he's thinking of me. And now he's explaining, you know, some children are born with, you know, limited possibilities, but it doesn't mean they can't have a, you know, a fulfilling life. Where the fuck is he going with all of this? Mm-hmm. You know, and he said, "I'm afraid your child is Down syndrome, but it'll be all right." And then he toddled off.
Right. That was it.
That was it. No follow through, no sort that one out. So the roof just fell on top of me. You know, the sky had crumbled. And I'm looking at my wife, who's now inconsolable in the bed. I think, Jesus, how do I cope? We were kids. Kids. And we're already coping with, you know, the whole thing of being away from our family in London, living in a flat off Cricklewood Broadway. We weren't exactly living comfortably, you know. So that just threw a complete hand grenade in the middle of everything.
When you wrote Scorn Not His Simplicity, was he still alive then?
Oh, yeah.
He was only, what age was he when he died? He was only four. And had he been sick all the time?
All the time.
You were waiting for that day, were you?
Kind of, yeah. And he was at home with us for the first 3 years, but then it's a congenital thing with the Down syndrome.
Yes,
a
lot the heart of problems.
With a hole in the heart. Paul had such a thing. So all he had to do was kick off his blankets during the night and then he'd wake up. So he wasn't thriving, he was coming poorly. So our GP said, "I think we should put him into there's a lovely residential place down and da, 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 and they look after him." So that's where he ended his days. He never really thrived.
Yeah.
We visited him one Saturday. We thought he was particularly listless, but you know that was part of the deal. Then we got a phone call on the Sunday to say that he'd passed away.
Oh dear! You're still only children yourself.
Only children, yeah. But you've kind of 4 years in. You've made the adjustments. You know, 4 years have accepted the fact. He was a great little kid, and he's smiling. And you think, okay, this we can handle. This is now part of our lives. Blah blah blah. And then that's the rug gets pulled from under again.
Mm. And had he speech? A little, he hadn't.
Never a little.
Did you ever hear him saying daddy? Or
Dada, you know, or something. Dada. Something very basic, you know.
Yeah. But no, and yet you wrote that extraordinary song about him.
Yeah, that's a song which, as you say, is a million miles away from, you know, Puppet on a String or Congratulations or the Bay City Rollers. But
there must be people still who hear that song, like right this minute, very minute, who have just got that diagnosis in probably slightly different times, but, you know, because there will now be counselling and help and organisations, but still.
Well, it's happened to somebody like that. It's nobody's fault, you know, that's the thing. So, yeah, that's a song which has given me immense satisfaction.
And is it one of your favourites?
Yeah, of course, I'd be proud of the ones that sold a million records. Both songs were number one in America, songs recorded by Elvis Presley, all that, because that was my job, you know. But there's a different kind of satisfaction from the likes of Scorn Not or The Town. They would be the two that would be closest.
Okay.
they dig deep into the human soul.
Phil, obviously losing your son at 4 years of age was a terrible tragedy, but you've also had to have the tragedy of losing a brother and a sister in quick succession.
That was a tough period, a kind of dark period. I had a pain in my arse dealing with undertakers, you know, because in between my brother and my sister, my father had died.
And then your daddy died, you know?
Brian.
Where was Brian in relation to you now?
He was the one above. Sid, my sister, was the one underneath. So Brian's death, you know,
he drowned
in both those cases. In both those
a surfer,
cases,
was he?
He windsurfing. He'd windsurfed all around the world. He wasn't, you know, some kind of an amateur at it. So it was in the month of December, you know, when only serious people are out windsurfing, wetsuits and all that kind of stuff. And normally they would windsurf in twos, people who are serious about it. So he went down to Fond, which is just across the border on the shores of Loch Swilly, to pick up his pal Jim. And they would normally go on the Sunday afternoon on Loch Swilly. But Jim was having a birthday party for his one of his kids. And he said, Brian, you go ahead, kit up and go out, and I'll join you later. So Brian went down, kitted about out on his own. And then, as happens in that part of the world on the Swilly regularly, the weather changed, the winds got up, and short order, he was taken out, taken out to sea. Frustrating thing was there were people driving between Fawn and McCran who could see when the board being knocked over all the time, knew he was in difficulty, but there were no boats in the water. Somebody called the guards, but what could they do? You know, there was no lifeboat, of course.
No lifeboat there.
There were no pleasure craft because it's December. So that started off a lobby between Brian's friends, my friends, people in around about Buncrana and Loch Swilly, to lobby the RNLA to get a boat. I did a few concerts to get the kind of startup funds to help get the boat in place in Ned's Point. And that's very significant day. I remember at the launch of that boat. And there's an interdenominational service at Ned's Point as they launched the boat. And I'd never heard the song of "To Those in Peril, for Those in Peril on the Sea" before. And heard the choir sing. And when I hear it now, it always just gives me goosebumps. Mm-hmm. I'd never heard the song, but it's wonderful. Just that power of music again, I suppose. Mm-hmm. So apart from raising a few quid for the RNLA, I can do my bit to raise an awareness, you know, some profile. So I wrote Home from the Sea. Which has now become a kind of an anthem for the RNLA, whether it's around the coast of Ireland, Scotland, Wales, or the United Kingdom. When a new lifeboat is launched, that's the song we sing.
Yeah. And then the following year, you had the same.
Yeah, that was worse. You know, that was worse because even a lifeboat couldn't have saved my sister. She was a counsellor for people with drug and alcohol addiction problems. Such a big heart, you know, that's why she got herself into that job. She was my wee sister, but she was, you know, gentle soul and caring, which cost her life at the end of the day. Again, it was a birthday party, strange enough. Her 10-year-old, she'd just taken the ice cream cake out of the fridge, and then she got the call that they put the ice cream cake back in the fridge. Again, listen, I gotta go, but we'll do this when I come home. But she never came home. So yeah, he was on a trip and car into the water.
Dear God, you said did your daddy die in between those two?
Thanks be to God, because I would have killed him.
I
mean, Brian's death very nearly did, you know. I mean, I think he went downhill after that. But that would.
Was your mommy still alive then?
No, she was gone.
She was already gone.
Fortunately, yeah.
How do you cope?
You find a place, you know. You find a place in your heart where you kind of lock that kind of thing away.
Do you?
But it's a wound that never quite heals, you know. And funny enough, when I was doing the research for the memoir that I published a couple of years ago, Bruised Never Broken, that's an exercise, and you know, when you're researching something like that, it's like you're going to a filing cabinet of memories, you know, and you're pulling out memories here, there, wherever. But you normally wouldn't visit, you know.
Did you find it hard doing that though?
I found some of them great. Some of the others were a bit, you mean, like the things we're talking about, when you relive those, they reawaken those old kind of
wounds.
Yeah, you know, it kind of seeps a little bit.
You and Geraldine have had a wonderful, happy life together now.
Thanks be to God.
And great kids.
Six kids later.
Yeah.
When we meet folks, because Geraldine, she was the star performer in our family before I was. I mean, I was happily making my living in the background, while Geraldine was a performer on her own, right? So when people hear we've got six kids and they say, and how many are in the music business?
Yeah.
We go, none.
In the none.
Oh, that's a shame. I go, that's a relief. Because they don't realise how tough it is, you know.
Yeah.
There's only one still in Ireland. Dominique's still in Dublin, but they're all grown up. They're all kind of you know, adult.
Many grandchildren.
One in New Zealand, two in Australia, and one in Ireland here.
Oh, you must spend a lot of time travelling, do you, to see them?
Not
all?
Anymore.
Do you not?
The idea,
they come to you, do they?
Aye, that's the
okay.
Thing. I mean, I've seen enough airport girls to see me through.
You wouldn't want to quantify how many hours you spent hanging around airports.
Airports, no.
Phil, didn't Geraldine, wasn't she in the Eurovision as well?
She was indeed. Yeah. There's another story. In 1975, having won the Eurovision in 1967 with Puppet on a String, having come second with Congratulations in 1968, and then being the producer and the arranger and the orchestrator and publisher of all kinds of everything, mm-hmm. which won in 1970. Mm-hmm. So I had a first, a second, and a first within a four-year period. So in those days, the most successful country in the Eurovision Song Contest was Luxembourg. Why? Well, Luxembourg doesn't have any indigenous music industry per se because it's a bit the size of Bray. But so they approached me because of that track record and said, we would like you to write the song to represent Luxembourg and we'd like you to find a singer. Oh, that was a nice gig. Yeah, sure, mm-hmm. we can do that. Because I figured I'd gone as far as I wanted to go in the Eurovision. Mm. I didn't really want to be boxed as a Eurovision songwriter. But when I got that offer, oh, absolutely. Let's have a piece of that. So I was living in London, obviously, at the time. I looked at a lot of singers. Nothing really very exciting. Then I was back in Dublin. Different business entirely. I'm staying in Jury's Hotel, as it was back in those days. And there was an ad for Guinness that came on. That'll always get my attention. But this one was set in a club. And there was a five-piece band. And a girl singer with long hair. And I thought, whoa, she looks the business. The camera loves her. Big long hair and great cheekbones. Whatever. No, that would translate into it. Because the Eurovision is a very visual thing, even back then. So I thought, I better check her out. Made it my business to find out who she was. Got a phone number. Called her up and I said, I'm Phil Coulter. She vaguely knew who I was. I said, this is a Eurovision Song Contest. I'm kind of putting together something. And if you're interested, I said, I'm flying back to London early in the morning. But if you're interested, we got to have a quick conversation to see if there's any interest. And maybe I'll get you to London to audition. So she said, OK. 9 o'clock the following morning, I turn up at her house in Castle Knock. The milkman had just been. And in those days, the milkman delivered the milk, right? Two pints. So I pick up the pints and I ring the doorbell. And this gorgeous creature answered the door.
Is this Geraldine now?
This is Geraldine.
Oh, yeah.
I'm standing with the two pints of milk. And the best line I could come up with, I had been confronted by this fucking goddess. I think these are yours. So that was a start.
Oh, for goodness
so
sake.
So 6 kids later, I mean, something worked that day. Yeah.
And Phil, can I just ask you, because, I mean, I had the honour and I loved presenting it with the Eurovision. Yeah. What are your thoughts of Eurovision now?
It's a TV extravaganza. Mm. Sometimes when I look at it, I get the feeling that the hairdresser is as important as the songwriter. You know, it's all about the presentation and the dance routines and all that.
Do you watch it?
Oh, I do.
Yes.
Why would I not? I mean, professionally and personally, you know, I mean, I've got a lot. In the days when the 6 kids were around the place, we always used to watch it. I don't see it as a song contest anymore. I can't think of the last good argument. Listen, from a professional point of view, from a songwriter's and a music publisher's point of view, the question is this. When was the last global hit to come out of Eurovision? When was the last big hit song to come out of Eurovision?
ABBA.
Arguably ABBA. Yeah, that's a long time ago. That's 50 years ago.
74.
Yeah, that's right.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. 50 years this year.
The only time we ever flourished in Eurovision when we had a good song and a good singer.
Yeah.
You know, all the TikTok stuff, we're not good at that. Why don't they just forget about us?
Yeah.
Without pointing any fingers at any kind of acts, but I think I have never really, I've never been surprised. But we haven't got out of the heat sticking into the final. Because I just think they're going about it the wrong way. But anyway, that's you know, people know more about it these days than I do.
When they make the movie about your life, who do you want to play you?
I'll tell you a great story.
Think carefully.
We did a run some years back in the Irish Repertory Theatre off of Broadway in New York. The Songs I Love So Well, that was the name. But the second or third day, I'm going in early to rehearse. And the box office manager calls me over. I said, you're going to laugh from this, Mr. Crowley. He said, this morning, two of our regular theatre goers, two old dears, and they said, we'd like to buy tickets for this. But what we'd really like to know is, who's playing the part of Phil Coulter? swear to God. I love that. I thought, yeah.
So what you're saying is you want to play your, you want to be yourself in the movie?
Cillian Murphy, I think.
Yeah. Oh, Cillian Murphy.
Yes.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a bit young, fair enough. I think best choice, Liam Neeson. I mean, you know, he's same part of the world, etc. Uh-huh. The physical resemblance is uncanny.
Point, Phil Coulter. You've said that you are 82 years of age, but you look, I mean, you kicked 20 off that. You look so, so well. Is kind of keeping fit and health important to you?
Oh, you Christ, yeah. I mean, you know, I don't want to die. I'm not obsessed. I'm not a gym bunny. I mean, I do exercises. Well, I kind of have to. At my age, my, you know, the bones get a bit creaky. I have to do, for example, for my lower back, I have to do exercises every morning. So that I can stand up straight and walk normally. That's okay. My doc keeps telling me, Phil, if that's your only complaint, you're doing fine. Mm. You know, you haven't got like 30 pills to take every day. I've had no major kind of health issues.
Thank God,
stuff like kidney stones and whatever, but you know, nothing dramatic. Right now, I'm off the drink. I'll do that just to prove that I can do it. In June, we're going to have a little place down in Spain. So before we go down there, I'm not going to be on the dry down in Spain. No.
Oh, you like the wine.
Oh, jeez. Yeah. I've done my time with like spirits and all of that. You know, I mean, I did plenty of that in my days. And I enjoy a glass of wine.
Phil, before we move on from the music, I'd just like to know what it feels like for you when you're standing in the Aviva, say, and there's an Ireland match about to start and they're playing Ireland's Call.
That's a great feeling because, you know, different songs give you different satisfactions. And that, something like that which has now passed into the public domain. And I'm thrilled when like kind of the daughters of friends of mine who are school teachers, primary school teachers, tell me that kids sing Ireland's Call and think it's the Irish national anthem. And just a few weeks ago, when I had that little 6 or 7 year old kid singing it, and they
were stunning. Oh my God.
He was a great little kid.
He was incredible.
So I was called in for a meeting in the IRFU, who thought it was time that they could confront what had been a bit of an elephant in the room for a long time, which was that kind of uncomfortable situation when the squad, in which there'd be a number of players from the north, from Ulster, and in the stands, you know, you just have to go to Lansdowne Road and hear those northern accents, you know. Rugby's always been a huge thing in Ulster. And what people don't really fully appreciate that in the north of Ireland, in Ulster, rugby is a non-Catholic game in the main. You know, there are exceptions, but in Catholic schools, it's either soccer or GAA. So therefore, the guys that are good enough to play for Ulster and then play for Ireland are from that community. So for them, Our Run the Vein is not their national anthem. And bear in mind, at that period too, it wasn't a fully professional game. So you had guys like, a guy who'd be like a teacher in Portadown or somewhere playing for Ireland. He couldn't be seen to be singing the soldier song on a Saturday afternoon and then going to face his school friends and his classmates on a Monday morning, you know, in a non-Catholic school. So the IRFU said, listen, we've got to confront this. We need a sporting anthem. I think their thoughts were concentrated by the first Rugby World Cup in Australia. And what had happened in a few of the weeks leading up to that, there'd been an incident at the border when a Lord Chief Justice was blown up in a car coming in that direction, but in this direction going down, we're in a car, there were three of the rugby internationals, right? Mm-hmm. So that was all very fresh in the minds of the squad down there in Australia. So they decided maybe, playing the soldier song wouldn't be a good idea, just back off of that. So what can we do as an alternative? Somebody wisely suggested Danny Boy, which would have been a good substitute, but no, this gets worse. Somebody in his luggage had a cassette of James Last, The Rose of Tralee. Oh. That's what they played for the Irish National. So, I mean, it's a lovely song, but it's not a song you want to go to war with, you know?
No.
I mean, that started the process going, I think, boys, we're going to have to do something about this. So I think, you know, in retrospect, I think one of their smarter moves in the IRFU was to ask somebody from the north.
Mm-hmm.
Because I get it, you know? Mm-hmm. There's a sensibility up there which certain words, even when I sat down to write the lyric, certain words I thought, better stay away from that. You couldn't say, for example, and United, we'll go forward. Oh, yeah. United process here.
Yeah.
You know, and when we wear the green, we'll just be careful. So, I mean, again, the tune came readily enough. The lyric was the tricky part. And I struggled with that. They say, like, you know, the whole country, 32 counties. How do I say that? And the inspiration came when I came up with the four provinces.
Provinces.
Mm. That opened the door.
How did that expression come into your
head? Just working through it, Mary. You know, if I had to find ways of saying, you know, 32 counties without saying. So you just, I mean, you know, songwriting and lyric writing, is, you know, it's there's a lot of just
you
hard
say learn
work.
Your craft.
And it's the craft,
yeah,
again,
just
isn't
throwing
it?
Things
yeah.
out and throwing away that
trying an error.
Yeah, a lot of that. It doesn't know, there's no shaft of light, you know.
When the song began to come into public consciousness, there was a lot of muttering.
Oh, a lot. I got hate mail, for God's sake.
You did not?
I did, yeah.
Did you?
I mean, there was a lot of conspiracy theories. I thought that there's, you know that that term of endearment. I only discovered this when I moved to live in Ireland, away from London. That term of endearment they have for those of us north of the border. Pushy northern bastards. So it was perceived as being another coup by these pushy northern bastards that they're going to try and usurp the Irondavine for this piece of shit. So there was a lot of that went on. There's a lot of that went on. And it took a long time. I think actually it was on that famous historic occasion when we played England in Croke Park.
Croke Park.
I think that was it.
Yeah.
Because we were all on tenterhooks. I can't be respectful. God Save the Queen. Perfect. Respect.
Mm-hmm.
And then the decibel level, but the decibel level for Ireland's call just went through the roof. And I thought, the Rogers are finding it.
You're home.
Silenced
here. What a legacy. Extraordinary.
We didn't talk about the fact that you were a rally driver.
What?
Yes! Come on!
Yeah. Again, you know, it's...
You were careful of your health.
Well, back then, I mean, I was a bit more carefree. One of my best pals, a dairy man called Cahill Curley, CB Curley.
Oh gosh, yeah.
Yeah, he was rally champion, won the Circuit of Ireland, won Donegal, won Galway, won them all. But he's a pal of mine. And so when he'd be doing like the Circuit of Ireland, I would be on the road just supporting him and maybe part of the backup. And it's again, it's in my nature, you know, like. Watching like the Johnny Quigley band and the Borderland Ballroom and Muff, you know, when I was 18 in Queens, I would love a piece on that.
Mm.
You know, again, watching Cahill, geez, I'd love to have a go at that stuff.
Yeah.
So here's a story. I said to Cahill, could you teach me how to drive a rally car? He says, I'll do a deal with you. He said, if you teach me how to play the banjo, what a cheap banjo. And Cahill hasn't a clue. So I said, right, gave him the banjo, gave him a few lessons. And then he, in turn, took me down to Eglinton Airfield when it was disused then before it became the airfield, and just taught me how to drive car. So that was the deal. So I got the better half of the deal because then I kind of got familiar with driving, graduated up. By the time I finished, I had an internationally graded license, finished kind of the top five in my last couple of rallies. I was never going to be a world champion, but it was handy enough because I took it seriously, you know, and I'd been taught. And I was very focused.
You brought the craft thing to that again.
Yeah.
I suppose, the other thing about it was the circuit of friends that I made during that those years were a completely different circle of friends from the guys that I know in the music business. I mean, they weren't impressed by the fact that I had a lot of hit records. They wondered, could I drive a car? You know, so there was a great leveller and all of that, you know, which is always good for you, you know. Always good to be brought down to earth.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
if you were to change anything in... anything, doesn't matter in your life or in the lives of other people in the world, what would you be changing at the minute? What would you love to see changed?
It's a funny thing, but just talking about it earlier on, looking back and thinking about unfinished business, Queens is still unfinished business for me.
Is that seriously? Yeah. Where we started this conversation?
Yeah. I don't have too many regrets, but I do regret that I didn't finish the job.
Given I think you've done very well, though, Phil.
Yeah, I can't complain.
It's funny. One of the things that whenever I did the citation for you back in the day when you got your doctorate in music, it was in my own mind that was a completion, but you're telling me that it's not.
Well, I was so grateful that you did that because, I mean, the guilt and the shame that I was feeling about not having finished when you, I mean, pointed in the direction of, you know, the music department should have made a bit more effort to understand this guy who was a square peg in a round hole, but you should have seen he had something else to offer. I thought, oh God, that meant so much to me to think, it wasn't all my fault, you know.
None
it
of
really
it was your
did. I remember that. I remember it very well on the stage on the Whitlow Hill. And I remember sitting there, having newly crowned with the doctor, and then as the kids were getting their degrees and they were walking past, and there were two or three of the kids came over to shake my hand.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that meant a lot to me to think it's, you know, some kind of a bit of a hero thing going on there.
Yeah.
You know?
But the beam still bothers you. That you didn't bring it home.
I just It's not in my nature to leave unfinished things, and that's one unfinished thing that just is.
You came very close to it, though.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, how many years you were there? You were in the university 5 years, right?
Yeah.
So you must have come right to the edge of it.
Yeah, I mean, my last year. Yeah. I mean, it would have taken another year, I suppose. If I mean, I should have done it in four. I should have done it in four. If all the things being equal, if I hadn't gone down the various side roads. But I mean, look, it doesn't keep me awake at night. But, you know, when you ask the question, is there anything you would change? That's a bit of unfinished.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know what it's kind of maybe a surprising thing, but.
Isn't it? It is. I mean, go back to the craft thing. There's no such thing as just churning out a song.
That's why I get exasperated now, you know, with all these TikTok songs, you know, because they're not songs, you know. There's no substance, there's no structure. That's why they're never going to last, you know. But it demeans the role of the songwriter, you know, the craft of the songwriter. I mean, that's something I'm very proud of.
Put a number in millions on what you have sold.
Oh, I don't know. I really don't know. I'm not being glib about it, but I don't know. It'll be plural millions anyway.
Plural.
I mean, Jesus, puppet on a string, sold like 5 or 6 million records. and congratulations, you did more.
What about Elvis, Phil?
When I was in my teenage years and falling in love with pop music, and listening up in my little attic bedroom to this explosion that's happening in pop music, that had been pop songs before, of course, like How Much Is That Doggy in the Window, you know. Presley came out and just changed the face of everything, you know. Heartbreak Hotel, Don't Be Cruel. Little did I think when I'm listening on my little beat-up radio to Radio Luxembourg way back then, that Elvis Presley would ever be singing my words, you know. So to this day, if I'm driving late at night and I'm listening to the radio and some DJ with good taste plays My Boy, My Boy by Elvis Presley, I still have to kind of slow down.
Yeah. And did you meet him?
I have to tell you. I would love to be able to tell you that we kind of hung about and kicked songs around. I was living in LA. I was living in Beverly Hills at the time. And the promotion manager for RCA Records, which was Presley's label, I had known him peripherally. And he called me anyway and said, Phil, you know that the King is on in the Hilton Hotel in Vegas in a couple of weeks. He said, I can get his VIP. Do you want to come? I'm there. Are you kidding me? So up we go. Presley was sensational. So he's doing his encore and my pal Chuck says, let's go backstage. We'll get to meet him. Jesus, at this stage, I'm thinking, whoa, happy days, me and Elvis. You know, we sit at the piano, drinking Jim Beam whiskey. He'll tell me about growing up in the southern states of America. I'll tell him about growing up in the northern states of Ireland. We'll have a lot in common by the time this night is over. We'll be boozing buddies. Like I'm allowing my imagination to run wild. So we're backstage, Chuck and me, and Presley comes, having finished now, and he's got a minder on either side. He's got the towels around him and all that sweat. So he comes abreast of us, and Chuck goes, hey, Al. Hey, Chuck. Al, this is Phil Coulter. This is the man who wrote My Boy. And he goes, uh-huh, and walks on.
Was that it then?
That was it.
Oh.
But I had to drink my own Jim Beam whiskey that night, yeah. So that's as close as me and Elvis got.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was before selfies, I'd say, as well, was it?
You thanks be to God, yeah. They're the bane of everybody's life, yeah.
Oh, and that's been just fabulous, wasn't it?
Unreal. Be here forever. Listening to you. You have provided
the soundtrack to our lives.
That's
really
very kind.
In a very uplifting way.
Well, I've enjoyed it immensely.
And so we come to the close of yet another episode of Changing Times, the Alan Wood Conversations.
A big thank you, as always, to our producer, Enda Grace.
And also to our researcher, Anne-Marie Staunton.
And can I also acknowledge our sponsors, Kildare County Council, whose support makes the podcast possible.
We hope you've enjoyed today's episode. And don't forget to follow the podcast to receive notifications for every new episode.
So from beautiful Alan Wood here in County Kildare, bye for now.
Changing Times, the Alan Wood Conversations.
Proudly supported by Kildare County Council.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.